All I want is some crumbs. I've never really been one to quote the television show The Simpsons. Even after I read a very interesting book, which I recommend to anyone, a book by Mark Pinsky entitled The Gospel According to The Simpsons. Very interesting. However, I couldn't help when today's sermon subject reminded me of a very funny episode involving Homer Simpson and his overwhelming obsession in this particular episode with being named the Employee of the Month at the nuclear power plant where he worked. Homer has somehow come to realize that every other single employee in the power plant has been named at least once to be Employee of the Month. He has calculated that he is the only one left in the entire power plant to be named. And so at the monthly awards ceremony, he is anticipating the fulfillment of this great accomplishment. At the ceremony, a great hush falls over the assembled crowd of employees, and Mr. Burns, who is the owner of the nuclear plant, reads the name of the Employee of the Month. In his scratchy voice, he reads that the nuclear power plant's Employee of the Month is an inanimate carbon rod, which Mr. Burns then holds up in front of the crowd, and the crowd cheers. In other words, a simple piece of carbon rod is a better employee than Homer. Homer is beside himself with rage, beaten out by an inanimate carbon rod. Now, the episode takes a funny twist when Homer somehow ends up on a space shuttle. And after causing the crisis on the space shuttle, Homer saves that doomed spacecraft by jamming a rod into the airlock to keep it closed during reentry. And now, upon landing, Homer is sure that he's going to finally receive his just rewards. He's going to get that medal for being so heroic. And the media announces, you've guessed it, that the hero of the day was the inanimate carbon rod. I think it's safe to say that none of us likes to be in second place, especially to an inanimate object like a carbon rod. Although lots of wives might feel that their husbands have a preference for playing golf or watching sports to spending time with them. The person who is first in any endeavor gets all the recognition, they get all the rewards, and in sports, they're the ones that get the endorsement deals. The person who comes in second, let alone third, fourth, or even lower down, well, they get forgotten, don't they? Case in point. Like many of you, I cheered a few years back when Donovan Bailey won the gold medal in the Olympics. Do you remember that? It was a great moment. It was very exciting. Now let me ask you something. Who came in second? Let's get tougher. Who came in fifth? Nothing causes us more grief than recognizing that I'm not number one. I am not someone's favorite, and I will be forgotten and ignored by all but my closest family and friends. I'll let you in on a little secret this morning. Even though the first place favorite recognizable person may receive some, if not most, of the rewards in life, they are still prone to the same pain and struggles that all the rest of us have. The rich and the poor man both can face life-threatening illness. The first place athlete and the last place athlete can still struggle with dysfunctional relationships. The human condition is no respecter of persons. We all have needs, we all have wants, and we all have hopes. The question remains, though, whether you're number one or you're number 100, how do you get what you need in life? How do you achieve your dreams, especially when so many doors seem closed to all but the most connected and powerful? In Canada, we fear a development of a two-tiered healthcare system, but we all know that life itself is not equal. Some people do have more opportunity or wealth or can we use this phrase, just pure luck. When Mark chapter 7 opens, there was a prevailing mindset, well entrenched in Jesus' contemporaries, that the Jewish people were number one in God's book. To be fair, it seems quite clear that there was some truth to this, at least how the biblical writers looked at it. God had clearly set Israel apart, God had protected Israel, and God had wanted to use Israel for his special plan. It was to Israel that the law of Moses was given, and it was to Israel that Jesus was originally sent. God had wanted Israel from the beginning to be a light to the world, a shining example of righteousness and abundant living in partnership with a gracious and giving God. However, somewhere along the way, Israel's view of itself got a bit twisted. Instead of seeing their mission as to lead the world out of darkness, they saw themselves as called to remain distinct and to remain separated from the world. Through thousands of man-made laws, they drew a line in the sand, separating the clean people of Israel from the unclean, which was everybody else. Mark chapter 7 is an in-depth discussion in which Jesus seeks to clarify what God's definition of purity really is. Verse 15 reads, "You are not defiled by what you eat, you are defiled by what you say and do." And then in verse 20, "It is the thought life that defiles you." This theme of Jesus' teaching is prevalent throughout the Gospels. It's particularly prevalent in the Sermon on the Mount. This is the background for today's passage about a Gentile woman who comes in seeking help, seeking deliverance for her daughter. And this story is intimately tied to the discussion of purity that precedes it. The passage begins with Jesus seeking rest for himself and his disciples. On the only occasion that we have recorded in the scriptures, Jesus leaves the ancient boundaries of Israel and he goes into another land. He goes into a Gentile territory called Tyre, sometimes called Tyre and Sidon. Remember, Jesus deliberately went into this place, which Jewish people generally thought of as being unclean and full of godless heathens. Many of Jesus' contemporaries would claim that Jesus was defiled just by crossing the border. Jesus, however, is just too famous. He's too well known even in this Gentile region. And soon people come and they seek him out. They disturb his rest. One of the people who arrived very early on at the place that Jesus was staying was a Gentile woman. This unnamed woman is clearly identified as being Gentile by birth and Greek in her cultural understanding. But she's also very desperate. Her little girl, she says, is possessed by a demon. And if you want to know what that looks like, just read Mark chapter 9, where we read of a young demon-possessed boy who suffered from convulsions and who foamed at the mouth. This woman's daughter was in an intolerable situation. It was frightening. The woman had obviously heard that Jesus was someone who could cast out demons. And so she asked Jesus for help. Now what happens next at first seems absolutely stunningly startling. It's just scary stuff. And it sounds even cruel when it comes from Jesus. But remember, this is within the context of the whole chapter. Also, the woman knows how Jews feel about Gentiles, and just getting near Jesus in the first place was an accomplishment. It also must be said that Jesus speaks to her as a Jewish rabbi would speak to someone. He uses an analogy to make a point. and also to test your faith. The same strategy is employed by Jesus when he has his encounter with the woman at the well in John 4 and also with Nicodemus in John 3. You see, in the ancient world, there were these magicians, traveling magicians, who went around who could claim to do all kinds of miraculous things. Perhaps some of them had even tried to help this woman's daughter. And of course, they want to get paid to do it. So Jesus wants to know, how does this woman view him? Is Jesus to her just another traveling sideshow, or is he more? Is he Lord of her life? And taking a common scene from the life of the woman, Jesus says this. It isn't right to take food from children and throw it to the dogs. It's an analogy and it's metaphorical. It pictures a dog sneaking in and stealing the children's food right off the table. Jesus is pointing out that the woman has intruded into his and his disciples' time of rest, or in analogy, their time of food. She's required to wait at least to another day, to wait until the time is right for the gospel to spread out into the Gentiles around Israel. But the food first has to go to Israel. Now, honestly, the woman could have walked away disappointed, but the Spirit of God was clearly on her as she replies with faith and incredible wisdom. That's true, Lord. Notice she used the term Lord here. Even the dogs under the table are given crumbs from the children's plates. In other words, she recognizes that Jesus' mission is to Israel first and foremost. She knows that she's an intruder. She's seen by Jews in general as nothing more than a dog or someone who's unclean or someone who's a heathen. She knows in the Jewish mindset that she's second best. However, she also recognizes that Jesus has a lot to offer. Yes, let Israel have their bread. But could she just have a few crumbs? A few crumbs dropped to the ground as cast-offs? Just a tiny piece of Jesus' power was enough for her. Dogs under the table eating crumbs, well, they're not stealing from anyone. They're simply taking up the leftovers. My parents' dog is staying with us for a couple weeks. I call him Hoover. Not like our nice friends over here. I call it Hoover because it goes around and vacuums up after we eat. The woman has declared that she's placed her hopes and her daughter's future in Jesus' hands. He is her Lord. Furthermore, remember who is witnessing this interchange. This is also really important. The disciples are watching all of this. Remember back in verse 15, I pointed out last week that Jesus said, you're not defiled by what you eat, you are defiled by what you say and what you do. The disciples in the very next verse asked Jesus, well, what in the world do you mean by that? It's a question out of just non-understanding of what Jesus is all about. And out of frustration, Jesus says, don't you understand either? Can't you see that what you eat won't defile you? Food doesn't come in contact with your heart, but only what passes through the stomach and comes out again. So picture this. The disciples are now in the region of Tyre. They are completely surrounded by Gentiles. Now they are witnessing Jesus and confronted by a Gentile woman who by Jewish thought is second class. She is by the very definition of Jewish theology thought to be unclean. Just by being in proximity to her would make them all unclean. Jesus' little analogy about dogs and children's dinner, well, that would have been perfectly in line with his contemporaries. It's what other rabbis would have said. Any Pharisee worth his salt would have said something like this to this woman, but maybe with some more venom attached to it. But Jesus wants his disciples to see that what makes this woman clean or unclean has nothing to do with her gender or ethnicity or even her religion. It has nothing to do with whether she eats pork or whether she works on the Sabbath. It has nothing to do whether she's married or widowed or a divorced woman or a single mom. What makes her clean or unclean is what's in her heart. And what is in her heart is faith and selfless devotion to her daughter. Jesus doesn't care whether she's one of the chosen ones of Israel. But is she one of the ones whose heart is being claimed by God? I was challenged by a story that I read recently by Donald Ming, who tells of a time early on in his ministry when he was in his first pastorate. This is what he says. When I was a young pastor, a drunken man stumbled into the sanctuary during worship one rainy, stormy Sunday night. He was unkempt and he was smelly. In the eyes of some worshipers, the man was despicable. Even some of the church leaders came up to me and said, "Pastor, this man is no good. He is disturbing our service. Shall we escort him outside?" Thankfully, I heard God's voice speaking to me. I replied, "No, don't escort him out, but let him come in. God's house is for whoever wills." Revelation 22:17. When I extended the invitation to Christian discipleship at the end of the service, this man came to the altar, fell on his knees, and begged God for grace and mercy. He accepted Christ that night and became a transformed man and a dedicated church member. More than that, he brought his entire family to the Lord. All of them accepted Christ as their Savior, and they all became devoted church members. This story from the Gospel of Mark and many other ones from the life of Jesus and from our own experience remind us that sometimes the people who need our attention are the ones who are disturbing our traditions, the ones who are disturbing our rest, the ones who are upsetting our rules and our regulations. The frightening part of this story in Mark 7 is that if it was left to the disciples, this woman would have been rejected outright. And the religious establishment of the time would have considered them right on the money for doing so. They would have been good Jewish boys for avoiding this unclean woman, regardless of her faith or her stated need. I wonder how many broken lives have been lost to God because we were good, upstanding Christians before we were faithful servants of God. How much of the dinner are we hoarding from the truly hungry for God of this world? Are we even reluctant to pass on the crumbs to those who are famished for hope and grace? My friend Blake Edie loves to say that evangelism is really all about one starving man telling another starving man where to find bread. The Gentile woman knew where to find bread, but did she have enough faith to ask for it? As we read in the passage, she possessed the faith to ask. And as we also know, she received. When she returned home, we're told that her daughter was lying quietly in bed and at peace because the demon was gone. The message is clearly demonstrated here. What matters in God's kingdom are not who we are. It doesn't matter our ethnicity, our gender, our age, our marital status. None of it defines what God values in us. What matters most is who God is and the faith we possess. Jesus is the bread of life, freely distributed to all people. Even a crumb, the tiniest of portions, is enough to save, heal, and restore. But Jesus offers us so much more than crumbs, doesn't he? He invites us to his banqueting table to indulge to our heart's content in his grace and his love. Are you hungry for love? Are you famished for a sense of redeeming grace? Are you the starving person wishing someone would tell you where to find the bread of life? Well, as one who has known the hunger of wanting, the satisfaction only Christ can give, I will tell you where the bread is. It's in Jesus. I can't give you this bread myself, but I know who can. And he wants to come and offer himself to you. Come, ask him for bread and be satisfied.